Engaging conversation on the most urgent problem of our day and what you can do about it.
Now, the End Abortion Podcast by Priests for Life.
Friends, Father Frank Pavone here, National Director of Priests for Life. Welcome to our program and welcome to another episode of this series in which we are examining the briefs that have been submitted to the Supreme Court in this all-important abortion decision, the Dobbs case coming out of Mississippi, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. Today, we're going to talk with a longtime friend and ally in this great fight for life and faith and freedom. He is Vice President of the Thomas More Society and General Chief Counsel as well. Our friend from Illinois, from the Chicago area, Peter Breen. Peter, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Father Frank.
And I want to tell our viewers also, of course, you served in the state legislature there in Illinois, not an easy state to maneuver with the challenges we have on these various issues. But you served for 4 years as a state legislator, and you were also the floor leader for the House Republicans. So I remember talking with you during the course of those years and the many things you did. But you really stood strong as a light in the darkness. So thank you for that as well.
Sure. And I'll tell you, as tough as politics is and as depressing as it is probably for folks, particularly in blue states, there's still a lot of work that can be done by good principled legislators. So don't disengage. Now is really the time to re-engage, especially when you feel the worst. Usually that is the time when you need to be the most active.
It's so true. Yes. And thank you for that that reminder and that witness. So I have in my hand here a document that you are very familiar with. Of course, you work closely with our other good friend, Tom Brekka, there at the Thomas More Society. This is the brief that the two of you submitted to the U.S. Supreme Court in this current Dobbs case. And I want to go into some of the legal arguments and have you break them down for us. Before we do that, for our viewers that aren't familiar with Thomas More Society, tell us in a nutshell what it is.
But the Thomas More Society exists to restore in law the respect for life, family, and religious liberty. We've been at really officially for almost 25 years, but really with the work for Joe Scheidler in the Now v. Scheidler case, it goes back, you know, it stretches back now, we're talking 40 years, where Tom Brekka, who was our founder, started doing this work on the side. He was a business litigator, very well accomplished. And eventually his firm said, well, you know, you quit the case for Joe Scheidler or quit the firm. And Tom said, I can't quit on my client. And so that began this wonderful adventure that then now has blossomed into this coast-to-coast organization, the Thomas More Society, that has been so involved in so many fronts of our culture war and really defending our faith and our freedoms across the country.
You know, of course, you mentioned Joe Scheidler. We miss him. He's recently deceased early this year, 2021. You know, as you were talking, it brought back a strong memory of mine. One of the three times that his case went to the Supreme Court, I think it was the first time, I was there with him at the oral arguments. And I remember we had mass that morning. I offered a mass over at the Basilica before we headed over to the court. And then just before going into the court, I gave the whole team a blessing. And boy, those were memorable days, weren't they?
And the thing too, that case, I mean, it really has lessons on perseverance because we lost the first Supreme Court case. In fact, the way the case went, we had won in the lower courts and then lost at the Supreme Court unanimously on a particular point of law. And Tom Brekka has always said, if we didn't get whacked so hard by the Supreme Court the first time, we might not have made it back, you know, that second and then the third time. But again, there were lots of days when folks were sitting there, you know, people were saying, oh, Joe, you need to settle. You need to back down, get out of there. And folks, they just persevered and good things happen at the end. You know, it doesn't always happen at the end. Sometimes we have to wait a little longer. But in this particular case, I mean, we've got wonderful Supreme Court precedent that is now being studied in law schools on the importance and the protections provided for folks who are on the sidewalk doing that good work in front of the abortion clinics, the direct, direct work with the young women.
Exactly. So let's talk about now this new kid, this new Supreme Court case, the Dobbs case out of Mississippi. I mean, essentially, they're reviewing a very, very basic question. May the states protect the unborn prior to viability? That, in other words, is the question they're looking at. And really, that does involve a fundamental question of whether the court will, as it now has the opportunity to do, actually reverse Roe versus Wade. I want to walk with you through the arguments that this brief makes, Peter, and have you explain some things. First of all, you know, the abortion side, of course, they're looking at abortion as a fundamental right. They think it's guaranteed by the Constitution. They find it somewhere in the 14th Amendment and something called substantive due process and liberty interests. And yet, you know, you and I can pull out the Constitution right now and read through it, and the word abortion doesn't appear anywhere in that document. And so explain to us this concept, because you address it right here in the brief, that if something is not explicitly in the Constitution, constitutional lawyers will look at, well, is it deeply rooted, is this freedom that you're claiming to have, in this case, freedom to have an abortion, is it deeply rooted in the history, in the legal traditions, in the practices of America? Where does that principle come from? And how do you answer that question in this brief regarding abortion?
And I'll tell you, Father Frank, when we started with this brief, this issue, it's called substantive due process. And it's almost, it's something of a cleanup principle, which is, you know, there are certain things that didn't make it into the Constitution, but are so fundamental to well-ordered society, essentially. You'd sit there and go, well, we didn't expressly mention it in the Constitution, but obviously it's part of our bundle of rights as free people. And so that's how important those rights are supposed to be. So under substantive due process, I mean, you're talking about things like, the right to parent your children.
Right.
Think about the real tangible things you must have to have a proper functioning human society. And so, and that's really, I would say, my 50,000 foot view of what that principle, substantive due process, is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Now, because obviously we all sit here and go, we read the Constitution. It says nothing about abortion. It doesn't say anything near anything about abortion other than possibly protecting people's lives, which, you know, would seem to lend towards protecting the unborn lives. And I got to tell you, in preparation for our interview this morning, I went back to the Supreme Court docket, it's the importance of this case can't be understated, or can't be overstated, rather, I guess.
Can't be overstated.
You try to go to the Supreme Court docket, it is page after page after page. You are scrolling for a long time. Every interest group, with even a tangential interest in abortion, has filed a brief in this case, and it's certainly, I think everybody realizes this is the case where we're going to get Roe either overturned or not. To something we were noting earlier about, you know, the prevailing age and the politics of the age and all of that, I noted, and I hadn't really looked through the list of amici, the friends of the court on both sides. On the abortion side are some of the largest, most powerful interest groups in the country. And groups that should not be taking a side against innocent human lives, groups like the American Bar Association, which is supposed to be a neutral organization for all the lawyers in the country. We all belong to it. It's not supposed to take sides on something where 50% of Americans are on one side and 50% are on the other. And certainly as for a 15-week abortion ban, it's probably 70% of Americans are in favor and 30% are against. And then the American Medical Association. For heaven's sakes, we're not talking about the pro-abortion, that small little pro-abortion doctors group. We're talking about the AMA. They decided to line up against us on this. So we've got to remember, this is this is really kind of, this is the battle royal, and we are up against some real forces, as some of our major groups have been taken over by this abortion, the abortion distortion, et cetera. And yes. So I just wanted to observe that. And I'll tell you, Father Frank, I know we're going to talk about one of our amicus briefs here, but we had so many requests, and including your request from David DeLeiden to do amicus briefs here. We have lawyers that then went and filed other amicus briefs in this very case. We can talk a little bit about it later, too. So we have our fingers on three different amicus briefs in the Dobbs
That's right.
matter. Right. And so
That's
it
right.
is. Well, and I got to tell you, there are so many amicus briefs. There's a lot of repetition, but some of these arguments are really critical. And I'm glad we're covering some of those today.
No, I think these are masterpieces. Yeah, these briefs are masterpieces. They really are. And that's why we're doing this this series. We're interviewing as many of the groups as we can to really delve into these arguments. So thank you. Thank you for all this work. So, Peter, this concept then, this principle that something has to be deeply, if it's going to be considered a fundamental liberty interest, it's got to be deeply rooted in the history, legal traditions and practices of the country. You go into that in this brief, don't you? And what do you discover there when it comes to the so-called right to abortion?
Well, and this is something, we had two different briefs that really addressed this. And what happens, we came at it from one angle, a historical angle, and a brief by Paul Linton, who was a great, he used to work in Americans for United for Life. We're privileged to have him working on our team. He went back to English common law to the 13th century, talking about the fact that abortion was illegal way, way back. Now, they had a concept they called the quickening, which is, you know, and I don't want to botch it. I believe that's roughly when you feel the first kick. You know, I think that's maybe a traditional concept in certain religious traditions as well. And in part because they didn't understand biology to the level that we do today. And so back to the 13th century, at least in English common law, which became the law of the colonies, this was a crime. Commentators in the 16th century, I believe it was Blackstone, he said, in fact, 13th century, they said it was homicide at that point to commit an abortion. After the quickening, 16th century, Blackstone was, he was less equivocal as to whether it was actually murder, but he said, well, it was certainly a serious prison offense. And that became our law in the colonies. And then in the 19th century, the states adopted laws banning abortion and did not include the quickening concept. They just said, look, if you take out a child in the womb, you know, that is a crime. It's a serious crime, usually murder. That's where we're
at. I'm sorry. Yeah, let's look at that a little more closely because you the brief points out that this distinction was there initially, a quickening. So somewhere around 16 to 18 weeks, you know, mom starts to feel the baby kicking. Doesn't mean that's when the baby starts moving, as we know now. The baby moves way, way, way earlier than that. But the point is that that wasn't to say that the baby wasn't a human beforehand or valuable before that. Wasn't that more in terms of what legal evidence one could have that the baby is alive and that abortion killed the baby, right? It was more of an evidentiary matter than a philosophical statement about what that life was before quickening.
Well, and you're talking about a time when, you know, we didn't have pregnancy tests at the local CVS or Walgreens.
No ultrasound.
Right. Right. I mean, we're talking the 13th century. I mean, if we're there, we're on a farm somewhere in the middle of the feudalistic, society. Quickening was really the place where you might have thought you were pregnant, but you're not quite sure. And so, you know, that was the place where they drew a line. And again, you know, they did not, have an understanding of embryology, of how the human, the human biology works. So, But for us, the idea that this quickening was there, it just shows that there is this recognition that is a human life, and that you may not terminate it, and that's something when we carried through to the 19th century. There are arguments by some on the other side that the abortion laws of the 19th century, you know, had some other purpose. And something other than protecting the life interest of a human child. Right. And that is something. And look, I got to tell you, one of the fundamental problems of abortion, and when you talk to people, we get ourselves so twisted up because you have to try to explain away the murder of an innocent child. And that takes a lot of logic and a lot of twisting. So the idea that somehow we would in the 19th century do tougher abortion laws than the English common law, which came to us, we would do tougher laws, and the other side would say, no, that wasn't what they meant. You see, they're going, they banned abortion flat out. You know, and again, you get an exception for the life of the mother. The little here and there, there are exceptions, extremely rare cases. But the central thrust of the point is there. These are human beings, and we don't terminate them. We don't kill them. Kill an innocent human being.
Exactly. Well, for those listeners and viewers that are just joining us, we are talking with our friend Peter Breen from the Thomas More Society up there in Chicago. And we're talking about the briefs that he was involved in submitting to the Supreme Court. Peter served in the Illinois legislature for several years and has been a longtime ally in this pro-life fight. So Peter, again, we hear the other side trying to say, the 14th Amendment gives people the right to have an abortion. And this brief points out, hey, look, at the time of the 14th Amendment, there were 37 states at that time, not yet 50. This was 1868. The 14th Amendment was adopted. 30 of those 37 states prohibited abortion. As you're just saying, the laws of the 19th century, they were passed. The quickening distinction was erased. And in all but three of those states, as the brief points out, this prohibition on abortion was throughout the entire pregnancy, wasn't it?
And that's the thing. There are these strains of thought in the law, and one of them, originalism, has fortunately become more popular now. And the whole point is, you look at what were folks thinking at the time they passed a particular legal provision,
right?
Obviously, I mean, you explain that to, your average person on the street or your average kid, a young person, a teenager or what have you, say, well, how should we interpret the law? It has this certain legal term. It has certain terms. Shouldn't we interpret it the way they were thinking at the time? So the idea that the 14th Amendment could be applied to make something illegal that was not just legal, but widespread illegal at the time, it boggles the mind. And again, that's why we get, when you look at some of the amicus briefs, these amicus briefs from the American Bar Association, American Medical Association, other big, powerful groups, I start reading through them and they can't attack the fundamental logic, the fundamental humanity of the child or really the history here. They have to go into, it's going to be, difficult for this person, or it could be difficult for that person, all while ignoring the person who is most affected by the abortion procedure. So, I mean, that's the thing. It's interesting to watch. I mean, I cannot imagine serving as a Supreme Court clerk right now and having to read these briefs because, there's one guy or gal somewhere in a dark room who's having to sit there and go page after page after page.
For
us at Thomas More, we are blessed to be able to file these briefs, to be able to come at it from a couple different angles, coming at it from the perspective of, the history and tradition, come at it from the humanity, the actual science part, and then even come at it from the more modern perspective, that David Dalyden and his work brings, that 15-week-old, children, they are some of the most valuable. That 15 to 20 week, particularly, that's where they try to turn. I mean, that's where there is highest commercial value. Again, as sickening as that is, commercial value for those little babies in the womb.
I was going to bring this up. I was with David recently. He and I were both speaking at a big pro-life banquet in California, and we were chatting a little bit about the court case and about the brief that he put under his name, and of course you guys worked on. Let's summarize that argument. I mean, basically, what David's saying to the court is, hey, my research unveiled this selling of the body parts of these aborted babies. Well, if these babies at 15 weeks and subsequent, like you just said, are so valuable that their human body parts can be sold in this way, maybe they're valuable enough for the law to protect. Isn't that his basic argument?
That is. And so when you're filing an amicus brief, a couple different reasons to file an amicus brief. One is to, so we've got one brief that was more of a history lesson, because the history in Roe v. Wade, and I know Clark Forsyth and some others have really gone deep in this, and Paul Linton, who had worked with Clark, who was our brief drafter, they've gone deep on this stuff. The history, and for something so important, you need to do the history lesson, figure out how we got here. So that's important. Others, you can provide a scientific expertise. Our brief on the science was more that way. And we've been doing a lot of science briefs in other contexts. And so we brought that expertise in here. And then sometimes you do something where you maybe bring a different angle that folks had not thought about. And you're bringing in a practical, something from almost ripped from the headlines. And that's right. What it brings in. And you're sitting there. When he first proposed this, he said, I'd like to do a brief. And I said, well, David, why would you do that? I'm sitting here thinking of substantive due process and the history and the science. And he said, well, these are the most valuable babies to the fetal tissue companies. And I mean, that realization, and they are valuable because they're human.
Yes.
That is an incredible little, for all the time we've been doing this, for the decades we've been fighting the fight, that particular insight was probably one of the few new insights I've seen from the legal front. And so that's why it was so, it was vital to get that in front of the court. And you never know what's going to catch folks' attention. As lawyers, we've been trodden the same ground. And so you feel like sometimes you're like, it's the same old thing. And there's always a new twist. But this one was really, it came in from out of left field. And you're sitting there going, it ties it very nicely to just a place where we've had rampant abuse across the country in this fetal tissue business, and it's right on these babies who are being protected by the Mississippi 15-week abortion ban. So that was I loved that part of it. David DeLayden always brings he's a creative guy. He always brings a new angle to things, and this one,
that's right.
Yeah, it was funny. So. That was kind of part of what David brought in. And we did some legal argument too. It wasn't all, all of that, but it was neat to be able to do that and to bring that unique perspective in from David.
Well, to bring out of that tragedy, out of that horror, people were horrified to see those videos of these abortion people talking about selling the livers and the brains and it's just beyond words. But to bring out of that horrible situation a powerful argument like this to the court, that's classic bringing good out of evil. And you mentioned then one of the briefs also went into a lot of the science. Tell us more about those arguments.
Sure. There's the famous line, and there had been this, there was a famous line in Roe v. Wade about how, we don't know if they're alive. We're not exactly sure. And I'm not quoting it exactly, and I apologize for not doing it exactly, but it's just the idea that somehow the science wasn't settled on embryology. Now, that's a lie. It's a flat out lie. Right. It was settled by 1973. We knew what was going on in there.
We've
had movements within the pro-life community where folks said, if the Supreme Court just got that evidence, they would immediately reverse. Well, we know what's going on here. There's a lot of politics at play and some folks that are ignoring science. But that case does need to be made. If you're if you're going to reverse Roe, or at least reverse it in most of its parts, you do need to very carefully address that scientific point. And I have to tell you, sometimes, folks need a because to make a change. I mean, just in daily life. And if we could say, hey, here's this piece of the Roe decision that was utterly wrong and modern science has proved it's wrong.
Right.
Well, then that gives a because maybe to a justice that might say, I'm pro-life, but I don't know what to, I want to be, maybe I want to kind of straddle both sides or what have you. In the course of trying to count to five, getting to five, we know we've got three probably who are rock solid, and we got maybe another three in the middle there. We've got to grab them and pull them in. Yeah. And so this, that argument is something that could really help one of those folks to get over the finish line for us. Because this is the thing. We know that six Supreme Court justices are actually pro-life, and they're not Mario Cuomo personally pro-life, you know, politically pro-choice. I mean, they are actual properly pro-life people. We just have to help them to do what they know is right.
Well, Peter, that's where this is going to take a lot of courage on their part. I mean, I look at these arguments and it's like, you know, it's not just showing that Roe v. Wade is wrong constitutionally, historically, medically. It's showing it's just obsolete. It has been so. I mean, you also in one of these briefs, the one I have here, point out that, you know, the court can't just keep taking refuge in this stare decisis. Oh, well, we decided this already. We reaffirmed it. It's been, you know, it's almost 50 years. We got to let it stand. No, you don't have to let it stand. And in fact, Peter, just this one last point for our audience, they really haven't let it stand, have they? And I mean, Roe, in the subsequent abortion decisions of the Supreme Court, has really been substantially dismantled, especially by the Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Tell our viewers in a nutshell, I mean, some of the ways I got rid of the trimester framework, for example, it's changed the standard of review. I mean, Roe really has been substantially dismantled already, hasn't it?
Yes, and to some extent, though, you know, we still, as much as the trimesters might not be right there, we're still laboring under that framework. So it's even yeah. if it's not in, it's being observed as if it were there. And so now, as if it were there. And so we want to, you know, how it is sometimes. You act in a way where you think something is what it is, and then someone points out and says, no, not anymore, and you almost kind of have to go, oh, right, and some of the debate over the Texas abortion law that was recently passed and went into effect has brought this to bear, where, you know, if you're on the other side, you're sitting there looking at the American Medical Association, American Bar Association, all your cocktail parties, everybody you talk to is fully pro-abortion. And all of a sudden, the second largest state in the country effectively bans abortion, tens of millions of people, and the abortion clinics shut down, and there's a big hubbub. But then, well, the abortion clinics are pretty much shut down. And that,
yeah.
I mean, if that doesn't help to wake you from your slumber to go, well, wait, what exactly are we doing here? Where is this structure at? And why do we even, you know, why are we setting these various, you know, mileposts and the Planned Parenthood v. Casey structure and all that? It's now time. And I think when you look at all the amicus briefs, you look at all the attention, I am hoping for those of us on the more conservative side, we've been working for conservative candidates for president to get to the point where we have a majority of the Supreme Court to be pro-life, undo what was done in Roe. We're at that point. Every one of those, six justices knows they were put on the court to overturn Roe. And I know, that's part of the thing, you know, no matter how much they want to go to the cocktail parties and all that, at some point, whether they were put on there by, President, I guess we don't have anybody left for President Reagan, but President H.W. Bush, W. Bush, or President Trump, they were put there to overturn Roe, along with everything else, but that was part of the deal. Again, it's not a formal deal. It's not an official thing. And I don't want to, you know, imply that somehow there was a backroom deal, but in the same way, the abortion side knows that, you know, they appoint their justices expecting them to uphold abortion. We appoint ours expecting them to do the right thing for those yep. little babies. And so here we are, you know, the battle is now joined. It can't be avoided anymore. And that's the point we're making. You know, when stare decisis, when the Supreme Court doesn't like a particular precedent, it has no problem turning it over. We did in the death penalty context and many other contexts recently in less life and death context as well. So that's the point we're making. Look, you know, when you've got a decision from 1973 that even as it's every time we've addressed it, they've weakened it. For heaven's sakes, you can't say that's a super precedent or somehow stare decisis. No. Right. So that's where we're at on that one.
It's a beautiful moment. And I'm glad that we are working together in the movement at this wonderful moment, historic moment. We want to remind our viewers that you know, Peter, we set up a website, SupremeCourtVictory.com, and there's a prayer there that we invite people to say every day for victory in this case. And there is also the, there are these videos, these interviews like the one we're just doing now, and there are also the texts of all these wonderful briefs, including the three that you have been involved in bringing to the court. So thank you for your work on this. We look forward to the progress that's going to happen over this coming year. And we'll look forward to speaking with you again as well. Blessings to you, your family, and the Thomas More Society for all the great work.
Thank you, Father Frank, and thank you for everything you're doing to bring attention to this and to keep folks praying and on the same page to get us to that ultimate victory, which will hopefully be, we'll see it manifested a little bit at the end of the year and then into next year when we get the decision. You know, Lord willing, we'll have a new day in America.
May it be so. Peter Breen, Vice President, Thomas More Society, and Chief Counsel, thank you so much for being with us. Friends, thank you all for watching and listening. Spread the word about these programs. Spread the word about this case. And let's continue praying for victory. Father Frank Pavone here of Priests for Life. We will join you again next time.
This has been the End Abortion Podcast. To learn more, to help end abortion, and to connect with us on social media, visit endabortion.net.